It will not be possible in the time that we have to attempt a complete synopsis of the story of the ring. And we hope that those of you who have not read it lately will take the opportunity after the discussion to at least consider it in an abridged form, or perhaps read the libretto of the operas. The story itself has its greatest interest for us in its philosophical overtones. But there are a few points which I think we should first make as clear as possible. The ring, as presented by Richard Wagner, is perhaps his greatest ritual drama. Critics are of the opinion that, from a musical standpoint, the finest works of the composer are to be found in his opera, Tristan and Isolde. But certainly, it is in the great music ritual dramas of the Ring and the Grail cycle that the master reveals a kind of genius which causes him to stand out unique among the great composers of the world. The wealth of material from which he could select those parts suitable to his purpose were of such nature and quality, this wealth was of such nature and quality as to lend itself particularly to the preparation of a great epic work. And we must also at this point mention that the Teutonic mythology of Richard Wagner is more or less his own. He derived from a great many sources, but he combined, organized, and interpreted from a viewpoint peculiar to himself. And as a result, we find many breaks in the older tradition which he makes no effort to fill. And we find him dominated by certain metapolitical and psychopolitical intensities of his own. Thus, the symbolism of the ancient writings has been adapted to a usage or a presentation which was part of Wagner's personal philosophy of life. In spite of these points, however, I suppose that the ring is the nearest spectacle that we have today which would parallel one of the great mystery rituals of antiquity. The old rites of Greece, Egypt, India are no longer available to us. But in the story of the ring, we find a wonderful unfolding of cosmic drama, much in the spirit of the Eleusinian or Sabazian rites of the ancient classical civilizations. Incidentally, we must also note that, like most rituals, the story of the ring is susceptible of more than one interpretation. And this is especially true when we compare it with the Eddas and sagas from which the basic themes were derived. We know, for example, that long ago, perhaps at about the beginning of the Christian era, an Asiatic tribe migrated across Europe and established centers of culture in the European and Central European areas we know today, finally centering in the Scandinavian region, where this tribe established its dynasty and began its cultural development. This wandering tribe and its source might cause us to suspect that certain Eastern and Asiatic influences were present in the forming of Nordic culture. And this proves to be largely true when we examine the matter carefully. I have taken a number of the earlier works and examined them in terms of ritual. And I am convinced that we could demonstrate, in fact could reconstruct, a complete system of initiation into old rites and ceremonies such as those of the Drotes, at that time dominating the religious life of the area. Thus we should bear in mind that these stories have levels or layers of interpretation, and we shall try to distinguish only two of these this evening, and we cannot carry either story to its complete and reasonable end. We can only intimate. And for convenience and for the brevity of time, we must also mingle the sagas and eddas in a number of instances with the Wagnerian synopsis. I'll try to point out these interpolations as they come along, but we may not be able to do so in each instance. The great music drama of the Ring, so-called, is generally regarded as being divided into three operas and a prologue. The operas themselves, the Valkyrie, Siegfried, and the Götterdämmerung, form the basic unit of the work. To these is given a shorter but very important prologue, which sets the entire situation and gives us the beginnings and early developments of the great thematic structure which Wagner uses in order to explain his symbolism in terms of music. This prologue is called the Rheingold, and it is natural then that we should begin our consideration with some interpretation of this phase of the problem. The Rheingold actually begins with the magnificent theme of the Rhine music. And in the Germanic concept, the Rhine takes the place of the great ocean, the great deep, the great sea from which all life springs. The Rhine is therefore undoubtedly and inevitably the river of life, the stream of universal consciousness, moving forever, continuing with its strange, melodic, haunting melody down through the ages and down through the great valley of the Rhine. The Rhineland itself becomes, of course, the world, watered by the river of eternal life. And upon this water, the great drama of life unfolds, and along the shores of the Rhine take place the various incidents of Siegfried's great Rhine journey. Siegfried is the Gothic or Germanic form of the Nordic deity Sigurd, and the Sigurd saga of the Nordic area supplies the principal elements of the story. But before the arrival of this important personality in the scheme of things, we have the Rhine flowing on and on. And down in the depths of the Rhine, the sleeping gold, the gold from which is to be pounded the Ring of the Nibelung. Now, the Rhine gold itself is guarded by three mysterious beings called the Rhine Maidens. And the gold obeys the strange cosmic cyclic law that has been imposed upon it by the Rhine King. And the Rhine King is the mysterious master of all these things, hidden but the great power of law behind the workings of all the manifestations and phenomena of life. The periodic waking of the Rheingold, according to the original concepts of the early Nordic rites, would have to do with something that perhaps we can approach on the level of Buddhism most successfully. Because the Rheingold seemingly represents the potential of individual consciousness sleeping forever within the stream of universal consciousness. Individual consciousness is subject to the laws of the great king of the universe, the supreme power abiding in the recondite parts of space. This individual consciousness, under a cyclic motion, emerges from the universal, remains for a time, and then returns again to the universal sleep. Out of this motion of individual or separate consciousness existing within universal consciousness is finally fashioned the mysterious and fatal instrument of the great music drama, the Ring. And this ring, if we study its symbolism in ancient figures and engravings, almost immediately tells us what it is. This ring is the human ego, or ego consciousness, the sense of I am-ness. And this is the cursed ring, from which there seems to be no escape, and around which the sorrowful tragedy of the inevitable doom of the world hero is built. Now, individual consciousness, finally producing it from itself, egoism, causes to emerge a strange and magical agent. This strange and magical agent is the power of the human ego will, the power which bestows upon all creatures the ability to engage in the strange, fatal conspiracy which we call life. It is this ring, selfness, with its eternal dependencies, which curses everything that it touches, that brings death wherever it brings life. For it is part of the mystery of the ring that all things that live must die. And it is because our Father and the gods knew this upon their mighty palace peaks at Asgard, that they knew before the wonderful cycle started that it must end in tragedy, and that the only way to prolong their own existence was to maintain as long as possible this strange condition of self-existence. Now this ring then, as it is used by Richard Wagner, also has a second meaning. But this meaning is very close to the first and is actually dependent upon it. In Wagner, the power of the ring represents the principle of power itself, the principle which we would call energy, which sleeps in the substance and sea of universal life. It is this power which men have sought to possess since the beginning of time, and upon which they have built their entire legendary concept of progress, of growth, and of all the advancements which we dream about in life and nature. Thus the ring becomes the symbol of man's increasing knowledge of the use of universal energies, which this strange ring, which in its original form was a broken circle, almost always represents. When someone asked the late Professor Steinmetz what electricity was, he replied, power. And it is this tremendous temptation of power, the desire to possess it, the desire to use it, the desire to control all things with it, and the refusal of the individual to return this power to its lawful keepers, that finally brings the drama to its most tragic climax. Now down into the dark depths of the Rhine, the symbol of this endless stream of life, where the sleeping gold is beginning to waken and its gleams bring forth the songs of the Rhine maidens, there crawls and creeps a very strange creature. This creature is called in the Wagnerian cycle Alberich, and he is a Nibelung, or a dark elf, a kind of gnome, a distorted, disfigured creature that lives deep under the earth. And Alberich has come to steal the secret of the Rhine gold and to take the treasure from its lawful keepers. Now, in the old myths and legends, this power, this being whom we represent as Alberich, tells us something about the story of the Nibelung. It is supposed that the Nibelung is simply a term to represent these elves, or these little elementary creatures. But actually, in the story, we find a little more subtle interpretation. The Nibelung is not really just a kind of creature, a little gnome or something of that kind. He is a person who is distinguished by the fact that he has stolen or he has killed. The Nibelung, therefore, represents the abuser, the misuser, the power of selfishness, of ambition and of arrogance, forming a strange deformity in nature. Therefore, when Fafnir kills his brother Giant to secure the treasure, he becomes a Nibelung. And when Siegfried, in turn, slays Fafnir to gain the treasure, he also becomes a Nibelung. In other words, he becomes part of the tribe that has to do with the strange form of this curse. This is not as clearly revealed in Wagner as it is in the source books from which the material is taken. But we have to then consider that the Nibelung represents a genera, a kind of being or creature. In our particular case, we have a fair understanding of what is implied. because the home of these creatures is below the earth and in darkness. And it represents a kind of Helheim, or dark world. It represents, furthermore, in the old myths, those creatures that crawled out of the primordial life of nature, the monsters and giants of the Chaldean theology, the strange, mindless, soulless creatures that crawled out into light. And in the case of Albrecht, it represents matter seeking to steal away the power of reason or of mind. It is the lower world stealing away the power of the ego consciousness and taking it down into the material state to use it for the purposes of evil magic. Thus, three human forms, having captured the principle of I am-ness or of selfhood, drag it away in the form of the stolen treasure, and establishing themselves in their own dark world, try to use the magic of selfness to make themselves masters of the universe. We find as we go along that this story unfolds rather sequentially. But we must first of all now go back for a moment and develop a theme that lies earlier even than the Wagnerian cycle. So we go back to the entire concept which underlies it. And we know that we are dealing throughout the story with what is called the great hero cycle. And in each step and stage of the development of the drama, we find further representation of the concept of the world hero. So let us go back and try to understand this hero. And when we do so, we must go to the source work, which is the Volsunga Saga. This is the great epic work which deals with the race of the heroes, the selected people, those chosen to become the rulers of the world. This work describes how Odin, or Votan, the All-Father, the one-eyed parent of men, called also the Chooser and the Waiter, calls to come forth out of himself a race for the redemption of the gods. This race for the redemption of the gods, this race that must save heaven because heaven could not save itself, this strange group of creatures that must be engendered and whose growth and development was watched constantly by the gods, for in this race was their own redemption, because it is through creation that the Creator must be justified. Therefore, the great work of the creation is to bear witness, reveal, and release the powers locked into it by the creating process. So in order to attain the great prophetic end, the end which was revealed to him out of the wisdom of his single eye, beholding all things, Odin brought forth the father of the Volsung, and his name was Sigi. And it was this Sigi who undoubtedly was actually the historical Scythian prince who, traveling from the Near East, established the great hierarchy of the Druids, or the religious system of the Nordic peoples. Now, in the New Testament, we are quite often concerned over the problem of the begats, but we have them again right at this particular time, so we have to consider them. And from Sigi descended the race of the Volsung. Now, the son of Sigi was Raya, king of Hunland, and he, in turn, was the father of Volsung. Therefore, we have appearing at this stage an interesting situation, for with the coming of the third generation, or Volsung, we have the statement that then was born Volsung of the Volsung. This is the first time we have the name doubled in this way. Volsung in turn became the father of Sigmund, and Sigmund's son, Sigurd or Siegfried, became the end of the great line of the Volsung. Now the line technically ended with Sigurd or Siegfried in the German, but actually Siegfried had a daughter, and this daughter however, came to a tragic end because she was torn to pieces by wild horses, trampled to death. And with her death ended the entire race of the gods, or the god protective generated creatures. Now, how shall we understand this strange descent of the chosen race, the race that was set aside to save the gods, and yet which in turn the gods themselves were forced to turn upon when this race broke the great laws of nature as represented in the story of Sigmund? Actually, we know that wherever a world hero is referred to, we are actually referring to the whole race of humanity. Therefore, just as Adam was certainly, as his name in Hebrew implies, not a person but a species, so each of these important steps in the descent of the Volsung should not be regarded as individuals, but as stages in the unfoldment of mankind. We know from the Eastern tradition and also from a good part of our studies of anthropology that there have been in the world up to the present time five important major racial groups. These five racial groups, with the periods of their creation and development, correspond with the five generations of the Volsung. Thus, in the very beginning of time, we had the first species to appear. And this species, incidentally, as a result of certain ramifications, was involved with the creation of the giants and the various elves and so forth. In the Eastern tradition, this species is referred to as the Polarian species, the first type of creature that was to be potentially man that existed upon the earth. This creature, or this being, existed even before the surface of the earth hardened. He lived in a strange etheric atmosphere, for it was some time before the celebrated fall would take place by which he was precipitated into a material existence. But the first of these strange creatures was not called a race, but a species, because it had not yet developed internal individuality. And thus we have this first of Polarian species related to Sigi, the first of the descending order of the Volsung. The second race, or creation, or species, more correctly, was called by the Greeks the Hyperborean, or the people who lived beyond and above the winds. This particular species represented a further gradual descent of man into a state of integration. He was still far more fantastic than any concept of the missing link. He belonged in a strange animal world. He was a beast among beasts, but with one difference. Within himself was locked the treasure of the Rhine. Within himself slept the Rhine gold, the symbol of his own individuality. And therefore, although he could not be distinguished from other creatures, there was a separateness, a destiny, which he could not withstand. And finally, in the third generation of this family, there came forth Volsung of the Volsungs. And thus, in the third great epic, called the Lemurian World, the division of mankind into its present human bisexual structure occurred. And we have the appearance of the first true human being. It is therefore appropriate that just as we refer to the total motion as humanity, that we should refer to this creature as human. And in this sense, we have the same idea as the Volsung of the Volsung, the human being of humanity, the double use of almost an identical term. Because now man had emerged, and we have the rise of true individuality and the beginning of life as we know it for humanity. This, then, resulted in the rise of the fourth great order of life, the fourth great continent, and the fourth race, which we generally refer to as the Atlantean. This is the race that gave us Sigmund, the hero who failed, the hero whose sword was broken, broken upon the shaft of the rune spear of Odin. This was the disobedient one who did not even know his own disobedience, but was bound by a fate beyond his control to come to a tragic end. The tragic end of Sigmund was the tragic end of the Atlantean world. And out of the Atlantean world was born the fifth race, the race to which we now belong, a race which geographically originated in the Trans-Himalayan highlands of Central Asia. This was the race which originally called itself in India the Arya, or the consecrated, the set apart, the dedicated. All races have been so named. But this fifth race, which we generally refer to as the Arya, is the race which is likened to Sigurd or Siegfried, in whom all the hopes of the past had been centered, and who was hoped, it was hoped, would prove to be the savior of the gods. Now, in the period of the height of the great Germanic concept, and Richard Wagner was one of the leaders of this concept of German culture as being supreme, we had the development and indoctrination of the concept of hyper-Aryanism. But this, in no sense of the word, relates primarily to the original concept. Because actually the Aryas were a people that originated nearly a million years ago. And among the Aryas you will find almost every type of people that we know on earth today. The Anglo-Saxon was not the one and only Aryan. The Aryas included the Hindus, the Persians, the modern Semites, the Celts, and many other culture racial groups. So that this idea of one small people constituting culture was a purely pro-Germanic approach to the problem. But here we have the development of races under the name of the sons of Volsung. Volsung is therefore the prototypic man, the Adam Cobman, the collective humanity. And his children became one by one the embodiments of himself and the embodiments of his purpose. Therefore, we also see a strange melancholy fatalism lurking underneath the story of the fifth race, or the race to which we belong. And this strange and rather pessimistic outlook is more or less supported by the ritual drama itself and by the great political drama of the world as we live in it today. Because we are more or less copying or reliving the sagas, the strange story which they told and which they predicted and prophesied is really unfolding around us. Now, this little concept of the racial orientation of things and of the place of the hero tells us, therefore, that when the world hero appears, he is the embodiment of a number of different things. First of all, he is a psychic symbol of the human soul itself. He is the symbol of the archetype of human perfection, which lies locked in everyone. Secondly, he represents, in the operas particularly, the concept of intellect, or mind, as the hero of the world. He is also the ever-victorious and ever-defeated selfhood in everything that lives. He is the individual who seeks to conquer all things and fails because he has not conquered himself. His is, therefore, the strange tragedy of man conquering the universe but failing to be master of his own soul. Because upon him is a curse which he can do nothing about, apparently, a curse that leads him inevitably to the grave, and that curse is his own egoism. It is the ring of fire within himself that will never let him rest, never give him peace, but drives him on to the greatest illusion of all, the belief that he can rule the world. And this belief lures him on into dictatorships and tyrannies, into the most terrible tragedies of human life. Now, in the development of our story, the theft of the Rheingold, or the misappropriation of energy or life, and it's being turned over to the keeping of Albrecht the Gnome, also tells another interesting story at the time of the division of species in the Lemurian era. Namely, that at that time some beings came forward and became human. Others, through various perversions, lost their right to this direct descent and became strange creatures, monsters, that gradually vanished in the deep. But there was a monster that did not die, and that monster was a certain phase of human life. And these people, these ancient Nordics, declared that there were in the world at all times two kinds of beings. Those who had their spirits and their souls from the gods, and those who inwardly and secretly had their souls and spirits only from the earth. As a result of that, there have been two orders of people, always distinguished and represented in human affairs. One we term the idealist and the other the materialist. The individual who instinctively seeks within for strength and security, and the individual who instinctively seeks in his environment or in the outer world. Perhaps these two are ultimately only phases of one kind of life, but they have been differentiated and distinguished from the earliest of times. So there are those who would live to conquer others, and there are those who live to conquer themselves. There are those who have become the servants of men and thus fulfill their destiny, and there are others who have tried to become the masters of men and have perished in their ambitions. So these two kinds of people more or less set the scene for the struggle between the hero race of the Volsung and the strange, negative, dark, perverted group which we call the Nibelung. Now, the story goes back to many other moral depths, but we cannot attempt to explore them all at this time. We can only unfold a small part of the great story. Having thus come, however, to the theft of the Rheingold, and the crime which set upon the world this great curse, we have to follow this curse through its various ramifications, and we have to introduce other persons into this drama. One of those that we must introduce is not only the ruler of this strange drama, but in some ways a strangely fated being himself, and that is the Allfather. The Allfather, Odin or Votan, was not the original deity of this region. The oldest of the hero culture gods of the pre-Odinic period in Scandinavia was Thor, the great thunderer. He was a symbol of primordial strength, the strength of the Titan and of the ancient world. But when Odin came, he is said to have conquered Thor by the power of mind, and thus mind became master of matter, and mind became the undisputed ruler of the world. Now this in itself placed the entire universe at hazard, and this hazard is explained to us in the story of Odin himself. Odin discovered that through the power and skill which he possessed deep within his own nature, that he could solve all riddles, that he knew all things, and he caused to be inscribed upon the shaft of his lance the runes, the laws, the wisdom, the ancient truths of his people, and the most complicated formulas of magic. But Odin, wise and great though he was, ruler of the 12 aces that sat in council on Asgard on the great mountain of the world, Odin was not happy. He had several reasons for being unhappy, not the least of which was a nagging wife. Now this nagging wife, of course, was more or less a stickler for tradition. And whenever Odin, in his ambitions and in his personal escapades, overstepped himself a little, this nagging wife would step in and, as mistress of nature and of the laws governing nature, would insist that he mend his ways, regardless of cost. Now, apparently, from one of the old poems and the bard singers of these things, this nagging wife that so annoyed Odin was conscience, a strange and mysterious thing which kept whispering to him, and which kept telling him or intimating to him in some strange way that his own position was not secure, that he was not the person he thought he was. And the more this thought tormented him, the greater came his resolution to solve the deficiency within himself.
Therefore, according to the ancient ritual story, Odin, seeking the knowledge of things essential, seeking the basic facts of existence, performed a series of great sacrifices. He scarified himself. He injured his body. He shed his own blood in the search of truth. And he finally hung himself upon the branches of the tree of life. And still, the secrets were not answered. Then he called upon the great spirit of the Earth Mother, and she told him that the great tree of life, the Yggdrasil tree, which grew up through the three worlds, was nourished in its roots by a secret fountain that lay far below the surface, where even the gods scarcely dared to go. And Odin, determined to solve the mystery of life at all cost, descended into the strange darkness of the underworld where the fountain flowed and where the worms waited to gnaw through the roots of the tree of life. And there he came to a pool of water. And on the wall of the pool was a great face that looked at him sadly, strangely, silently. And this was the face of Mimir. And Mimir was the deity presiding over memory and over all the strange secrets locked in the mind and soul of nature. And Odin besought of Mimir that he should be told the secrets of life. And Mimir told him that there were ways in which his wisdom could be increased, and that the only way in which some of the answers would be given to him would be if he plucked out his own eye and cast it into the pool of memory. So Odin instantly, to achieve his end, plucked out one of his own eyes, because Mimir had told him that if his eye was single, then his body would be filled with light. And having plucked out his eye and cast it into the pool, Mimir spoke to him. The oracle told him many, many things. But when he was finished, the oracle told him also one other thing. And later, the great Earth Mother Erda substantiated the report. Namely, that no matter what Odin learned, no matter how much he knew, no matter how many secrets were open to him, he could never know the mystery of his own origin, his own essential nature, or his own destiny. These things even the gods could not know. And of course, the reason they could not know is obvious. Again, a study of Vedanta, or Buddhism, or Yoga, or Tantra will explain it very quickly. Namely, that the mind can never know the origin of life. The mind itself is limited to its own world. It can learn many secondary things, but the primary mysteries are locked from it forever. And another great symbol of the mind, who has just been brought to the motion picture screen in the Ten Commandments, Moses, symbol of wisdom, symbol of the guiding spirit of his people, the leader of the great pilgrimage out of Egypt and toward the promised land of Canaan. This pilgrimage is another version of the Rhine journey, the motion of peoples hoping to be led to security. But when they came at last to the entrance to the promised land, mind could not go in. And Moses went to sleep in the hills of Moab, and Jehoshua the son of Nun led the children of Israel into Canaan. The mind cannot go there. And wherever the intellect seeks the essential answer, that answer is denied. So Votan or Odin, as the symbol of the world mind, the demiurgus or fabricator of the mundane creation, cannot know the secret of life, its origin, its existence, its substance, or its destiny. These things are left for something behind mind, something that rests forever in the keeping of the Rhine King, in the deep mystery of the ever-flowing waters of space, the Tao of the Chinese, the stream of life. Votan, or Odin, however, was with certain help in these things, because mind has certain powers, or guides, or aids, or servants, which are very useful to it. These include the internal and external perceptive powers. And these perceptive powers are called in the Nordic doctrines the mind-born daughters of Wotan or Odin. And these are the Valkyrie, the hero maidens. And of course, the greatest of these is Odin's alter ego, his feminine daughter self, Brunhilda, who is his shield maiden, his guardian, his object of counsel. And when all the world fails Odin, and he is brokenhearted and he knows not what to do, he always sits down and discusses it with Brunhilda, who alone of all creatures actually understands him. And this understanding one is, of course, his own soul. And so the various elements of his nature and character are delineated. And Odin becomes this strangely perturbed being who must, in some way, develop a way to transcend the limitation of his own being. Now, Odin is the father of Sigi, who was created from him. Therefore, from Odin in turn, of all the races and orders of life come. And behind the archetypal man, Sigi, lies the great principle, or deity, within whom man lives and moves and has his being. The word man means manas, or is from that root, and implies the thinker. Therefore, the human being, rising gradually to its intellectual level, is unfolding the mind power of its original progenitor. And Odin is seeking constantly, through the extension of himself, through all the orders of life, to solve the mystery of his own origin and destiny. He realizes that his destiny is linked with his progeny, and that when the last mindful creature dies, mind dies. Therefore, he must die if his heroes die. He cannot survive them, for they are the instruments for the manifestation of his own intellect. In this way, we get a little further integration of the problem with which we are faced. So let us now make another brief study and take up the problem of this unpleasant little gnome, Alberic, who is constantly inserting himself into the picture. Now, Alberic has the power to steal the ring because of one quality which he possesses, and that is that he has forsworn love. In order, therefore, to become the possessor of power, man must forswear love. He must change the direction and purpose of his ambition. He must dedicate himself solely to the purpose of power. And because he has lost conscience, and because he has forsworn the deepest and richest of human emotions, it is possible for him to be dedicated completely to the fulfillment of ambition. And yet, here again, our Nibelungen friend must have a descent. There must be a descent in his line. And this descent must finally meet with the descent of Odin in the great struggle that is to come to pass. So what does Alberic do? Alberic forms a loveless marriage with a mortal woman. And from the union of these two is born a very strange person. A strange, dark, dour person. A person haunted constantly by the shadow of his own ancestor. And this person is called Hagen. And Hagen is represented in the opera, usually, as a typical Nordic knight, with his broad feathered helmet, and his great black shield, and his heavy black beard. And he is a very forbidding person. And he is the thrall of Gunther, chief of the Gibichung. Now, the Gibichung are a race or an order of people that live along the shores of the Rhine, and they have a kind of little kingdom there. And the ruler of this group He has a very beautiful sister, and there are many interesting personal involvements which are going to take place in the story. But it is in the court of this Gunther that Hagan lives. And Hagan is again burdened forever with the strange ambition, the great longing urge to power. He must be master of men. And he has become a strange and terrible influence, even in the court of the Gibichung. Now let's go back and study this particular little story for a moment and see what we can make out of it. Let us now imagine, as Wagner did, that by Elbrecht we have the man who possesses the treasure or power of the ring. In other words, we have the beginning of two lines of descent which Wagner unfolds. The most simple, obvious, and commonplace of these interpretations is that the ring represents gold and represents the curse of wealth, that it represents the entire tragedy of man dedicated to the accumulation of worldly goods. That gold has turned brother against brother and father against son and has brought one culture down after another upon the altars of personal ambitions. That gold is the terrible monster, and that until the age of gold is restored to its original glory as the golden age, we will never have relief from this terrible emergency. But what is gold actually but a symbol? Therefore, the thing that is behind gold is the fact that it has meaning. This gold that is buried under the ground here in the United States has no actual value except to gild picture frames and make high-grade dentures. That's about all it is worth. It has no meaning, but it has a tremendous glittering aura around it because gold has become the symbol of power. Power is a way in which man defines will. It becomes the symbol in the material world of the instinct of will within himself. Power is the thing for which men have betrayed men since the beginning. And power is the desire of man to rule, to dominate, to master, to become the complete ruler of the material world in which he lives. So Wagner tells us in Double Talk one very simple thing, that the power of the ring falling into the hands of materialism has caused a strange union between an elemental of the underworld and a human woman, and that from these two has been born the strange foreboding symbol of the union of divine knowledge and earthly greed. And that this union we call today by the rather delicate, scientific, and pleasant name of science. Science is the union of divine energy and mortal ignorance. It is the symbol of a magnificent universal agent which has fallen into the keeping of a gnome. This gnome being unenlightened mankind. And out of the union of human primordial selfishness, out of the lack of insight which marks the material state of man, and the union of this strange, mysterious, magical agent that can apparently do anything man wants it to do, has come this strange fetish, this ultimate determination of man to so increase in his mastery of the universe that he can actually conquer space. He may, there's no reason why he can't. But the whole situation has turned upon him as a horrible curse. And this horrible curse is perhaps as well represented by our present researches in atomics as in any other direction. It is ambition, it is knowledge, it is this endless pursuit of science by science, without moral or ethical overtones or implications, that places the world at the mercy of the one who knows, but not at the keeping or in the keeping of the one who knows what is right. And there is great difference between these things. So the union of ignorant humanity and a scheming dwarf produces the assassin, Hagen. Produces the man miserable in himself, haunted constantly by the secret pressures of his ancestral's ambitions. This being, who lives as a constant embodiment of treachery and deceit, and who ultimately plunges his spear into the back of Siegfried, thus ending forever the hope of the hero race. In other words, Hagen, representing materiality, material knowledge, threatens the survival of the spiritual dynasty. Threatens the survival of the God-born creation, which was intended to serve a certain end. Yet this God-born creation was not the product of the great keeper of mysteries, the master of the Rhine. It was the creation and product of Allfather, Odin of the One Eye, and therefore this whole creation exists only within the plane of mental phenomena. It cannot transcend it, and regardless of the part played by Hagen, the entire scheme must ultimately have failed. Odin knew that it had to fail. Odin knew from the beginning, as the old sagas tell us, that his entire venture was in vain, but that he would prolong it and continue it as much as possible. So here we have several of the characters or persons of our story. And in order to advance it as rapidly as we can, we have to eliminate a good part of the romantic and dramatic development and try to trace through the main theme or the main thread of the account. The account, as we say, extends itself through four elements. These elements are represented by symbolic creatures and experiences and by various steps and stages in the story itself. The four parts of the ring, therefore, correspond to the four elements, earth, fire, air, and water. And they also represent or embody the four vehicles or bodies of man, the mental, emotional, vital, and physical. Because all of this drama takes place within mundane nature, within the sphere of man's activities. And just as the story of Parsifal is built upon the number five, which is the symbol of soul, so the Ring of the Nibelung is built upon the number four, which is the symbol of matter, which is the symbol, therefore, in an involved and complicated manner, of the entire concept of the fall of man, even as Parsifal is key to the entire concept of regeneration. In the story, we thus find the emergence of Siegfried. And Siegfried, who represents the fifth race, is also the son of the widow. Now this is a very interesting parallel because it takes us back to the Egyptian story of Horus, posthumously conceived after the death of his father. After the death of Sigmund, Sieglinde bears a son. And this son is Siegfried or Sigurd, the hero of the world. He is like also a Parsifal, whose mother Hetzelida is the sorrow of the world and who never knew his father. This strange, peculiar parallel of the son of the widow goes back also into the Manichaean mysteries and is still preserved in certain of the symbolisms of modern Freemasonry. Therefore, this symbol has meaning and has a great significance. He is born of the widow. In other words, if we go to the rituals of the mysteries, he is born of the sanctuary or the sacred house of the rites, which is widowed by the martyrdom of the god and the loss of the living word or the symbol of power. Sigurd, therefore, like all of the other world heroes, embodies or personifies the concept of an initiate or an adept of the mysteries. The four symbols that he is associated with represent the four ritual degrees of initiation, which we will find much more simply presented to us in the opera by Mozart, The Magic Flute, where the initiation of the four elements is clearly set forth. But in the story of Sigurd, we find certain labors associated with him.